I'm Amy Gutman, and this is Perspectives in Motion, an original podcast about the people, the places, and the ideas shaping our lives in the age of urbanization, brought to you by Schindler. A quick note that this conversation was recorded prior to the COVID-19 pandemic.
We're joined by Rahul Mehrotra, professor of urban design and planning at Harvard's Graduate School of Design. Mehrotra teaches architecture with a focus on conservation and urbanism, using cities throughout India as labs for his students to develop successful integrated design. His Mumbai and Boston-based firm RMA Architects has collaborated on various projects with Hewlett-Packard, Novartis, Taj Mahal, among others. Welcome, Rahul.
Thank you.
Rahul, as a young boy growing up in Bombay, now Mumbai, how did you first become aware of and interested in architecture?
You know, reflecting back, I often think of the number of times we moved homes from the time I think I was 7 or 8 years old, both within India, my father was on a transferable job, but also within Mumbai. And I started becoming very aware of where space was organized, and I would get really excited. Actually, I was the only one in the family who'd get excited about moving homes because I was sort of, you know, kind of really curious about seeing how I might rearrange the space I was going to live in. And I think that slowly developed into an interest really for interior design. And then through good mentorship, I think I was pointed to architecture as being what my calling was really. And I think really in reflection, that becomes very vivid to me, that our own experiences as we are growing up in ways we respond to different kinds of spaces, kind of leads you to architecture.
And so from that point, that initial interest in organizational spaces, how did your passion for urban design and planning grow?
It grew out of just the fact that Mumbai or Bombay, where I was growing up, was transforming so rapidly. I think between 1970 and perhaps between 1980, early 1980, that city has seen so much change that I think it's unprecedented historically. And so as we were moving homes, I was also seeing the places we lived in, the surroundings of the places we lived in transform rapidly. And I got really interested in then understanding the city, looking at archival images, looking at and registering in my mind what might have triggered the change and what the implications of that change are. And so this sort of scalar shift from being obsessed about the little bedroom that I was going to occupy to the house as I grew older, then to the city as I became more aware of that environment within which the house was nestled, I think clearly upon reflection convinces me that's what led me to, from architecture, urban design.
With big issues that we're facing in the world today, like mass migration and climate change, the role of cities seems to be changing, but also the expectations of a city seems to not only be changing, but increasing. We expect more and more and more of a city. How do you see the role of a city changing? But equally, how would you define the challenges of cities today?
I think the most important thing to even understand the challenges is to kind of understand them on a temporal scale. Yeah. So I think when we talk about climate change, which has now become the largest rubric that everyone's using to understand how our futures are going to pan out, you've got to separate what I would call a quick change and slow change, right? So they are quick impacts that cities are facing today because of climate change. These might be storm surges. They might be sometimes disastrous consequences like earthquakes and, you know, or mass migration. These are quick impacts. The slow changes are changes with, say, the oceans rising. This is a few inches in decades, right? So we've got to separate how we might respond to both these temporal scales. And I think that's the mistake people often make, because most of the time we are responding to the quick changes. So we're building dams, we're trying to see how we can keep the water out. But the really productive thing for cities for the future will be if we pay attention to the slow changes, because that will allow us to make transitions. I think the biggest challenge in the future is going to be how we as professionals and citizens and politicians, but professionals, urban designers, urban planners, architects, begin to start thinking about the design of transitions, of how we make a transition from where we are to what we anticipate is going to happen to our urban landscapes. Too often, we've been, or for many decades and centuries now, we as a community think in terms of absolute solutions. So, you know, whether it's setting up a factory and building 12 million prefab houses to solve the housing problem, or to set up a dike around the city so we can keep the water out. These are absolute solutions. The solutions in the long term are not going to come from this kind of absolutism, but it's going to come from how we can intelligently think about how we make these transitions.
How are some of these challenges more universal versus more localized?
Today, the universal problems are great because we are now finally realizing we are on spaceship Earth. We are on a planet which has, as Buckminster Fuller said, no operating manual and finite resources, correct? So there's a whole set of problems related to climate change, related to ways demographies move across the planet, global capital that's sloshing around. We are intrinsically linked through the internet and through the reality of our times. The way these problems are solved and the way they land in a locality are very local. And that's when culture, society, local politics, aspirations all begin to play out. And the challenge, therefore, for good urban design or good urban planning strategies is how one is cognizant of both these scales, right? That is how we can respond to the context, but how we can respond also simultaneously to the context of the context, which is this globalizing world. And that simultaneity, I think we have to become much more aware of in the way we imagine our strategies.
What cities that you've noticed and become aware of are getting it right in the way they're approaching some of these challenges? And how are they employing pioneering techniques or solutions?
For me, cities that are imagining the future right are cities that I believe can work across various scales. I often describe the processes of urbanization as a simultaneous process of involution and evolution. This is something I borrowed from Clifford Geertz, who's a social anthropologist, where he looks at rice farmers in Indonesia who try to make their cropping much more complex by doing multiple crops within a seasonal cycle. And it makes the mechanism incredibly efficient, but it makes it internally complex, which means that if it fails, it takes them years to come back even to a normal cycle, right? Mm-hmm. Mumbai is an example where we celebrate slums like Dharavi for how productive they are. But these are internally complicated mechanisms, which are only about involutionary gestures, not evolutionary. In New York, there is a great emphasis in imagining how the metropolitan region works, how people come in from New Jersey, how people work in Manhattan, get back. They pay a lot of emphasis on their mobility systems, right? But they also worry about making Times Square pedestrian so people can enjoy public space, right? So we're working across two different scales, and that's what makes cities successful. The Bay Area in San Francisco, with the BART system, with mobility that allows that entire metropolitan zone to work as a singular entity, but also then the emphasis for improvement, for urban conservation, for the park systems, for how the waterfronts are dealt with. Those are involutionary gestures where you actually recycle land, you renew parts of the city to make it more efficient. This balance is really critical for the future. And I think systems that recognize this balance are the ones that are the most robust. They will also be the ones that will be the most resilient when we look at issues of climate change, because they not only have orchestrated much more land around the core of the city, but they've also worried about how the core city might function in the future.
In your book, The State of Architecture, you cite the figure of 850 million people who will occupy India's cities by 2050. Population growth is just one of the challenges that our cities are facing. How does architecture play a role in addressing this incredible and rapid scale of growth?
Architecture is actually a very critical instrument in addressing this question. India's urbanization trajectory is incredibly unique in that it's a country of 1.2 billion people. That's a lot of people. But India continues to, and I think for a while will continue to be 40% urban for 6 months of the year and 60% urban for the other 6 months of the year. So in India, what we're experiencing, and I believe we'll experience this for a few more decades to come, is incredible flux. When we talk about 40% urban and 60% urban in the varying 6 months, that 20% is 300 million people. That's almost the population of the United States. So you have 300 million people going back and forth between urban centers and what you might call a rural landscape. So where does architecture come into this equation? Of course, architecture has to imagine new typologies for this kind of flux. So let's take housing, for example. We've got to think about rental housing markets. We've got to think of maybe even dormitory type housing. How do you make viable housing for male workers that come in for a few months every year and go back? So the typologies and ways we imagine housing will vary incredibly. And architecture is the imagination we have to use. How are markets articulated? How are public spaces looked at for this kind of flux? That's a lot of people going back and forth. So these are cities in transition. These are transitionary conditions. And then often architecture doesn't become the central instrument too. So I argue that architecture is not even the spectacle of Indian cities, because in this sort of temporal imagination, festivals become a spectacle in the city, because you have rural migrant populations that are in the city for a few months every year. They have their own culture they bring with them, and often they aren't the spaces for them to articulate those expressions, those cultural expressions. So the form of the city has to be imagined quite differently when you begin to make temporal landscapes that accommodate this flux an integral part of the imagination of the city.
That raises an interesting challenge, but also an interesting solution that you've proposed, not only in your book, but in a TED Talk. You refer to impermanence versus the notion of permanence. And I think so often we think about buildings as very permanent structures. But yet you argue that impermanence could hold more value in terms of the solutions for some of these problems. It's almost like a circus coming to town, to take your example, where the circus rolls up and they roll out the red carpets and everything else. They come, they entertain, people learn something new, see new things, and then they pack up and they move on to the next town. So how do you see impermanence being applied on a practical level, and which specific challenges do you think it can solve?
So while architecture is a very important instrument in responding to all of this change, the other side of it is also highly problematic, because what architecture propels, and I see this as I observe cities in North America, for example, is it propels us into a condition where we often make permanent solutions for temporary problems. Look at the amount of abandoned malls in North America. These are in the thousands, not the hundreds, in the thousands. And so how can we think again on this temporal scale, where architecture is imagined maybe in terms of life cycles of materials? Maybe we design buildings to last for 10 years where they can be disassembled. It would mean a completely different imagination, right? In schools of architecture, when we ask second or third year students to design a weekend home for a family, you know, embodied in their imagination is a notion of permanence. They'll use heavy materials, the kind of embodied energy. What if we pose the problem in our teaching to say, you're going to design a weekend house for a family for 12 years because their kids are going to flee then. This couple is not going to go back there. How can you disassemble that? How can that material be reabsorbed in the planet? And so it is again then questioning and challenging permanence as the only premise for us imagining environments. And so that's one end of the spectrum. On the other end of the spectrum, as planners, for example, we can provide in our zoning many more spaces that are tied to a temporal scale. That is, we're going to give you occupation for this piece of land to set up a market for 15 years, and then you design the market in a way that it can be reversed, because that market might not be necessary if Amazon is the only way we even get our food.
You give this specific example, and it's a good one, of the Olympics and all of the Olympic structures that get built, the incredible resources that get poured into these things, only for many of them to sit vacant after. What are some other specific examples beyond the shopping mall? Because admittedly, that was something I think if you asked people 30 years ago, if they could predict the death of the shopping mall, they would say no. So what are some other examples where we can instantly identify, like the Olympic structures? Yes, of course, that would be a great fit if that could be an impermanent structure.
I would say we can look at infrastructure more broadly. And I think infrastructure, you have to break down into what is hard infrastructure and soft infrastructure. Now, hard infrastructure is stuff like the sewers, sanitation-related infrastructure. But I would also think forms of mobility like the subway system, etc. Social infrastructure, which is softer, is our public institutions, all the way from hospitals to schools, to community centers, to libraries. There's a whole range there. I think that entire gamut of social infrastructure, we have to think more in terms of reversibility and impermanence, because that society deals with differently, engages with differently, with almost every generation. Look at the humongous high schools in America that investments have been made into, becoming redundant. They're used for 8 hours in the day. They can't adapt very easily to become community places or even night shelters for the night, right? You could imagine all of this quite differently in terms of mobility. Neighborhoods change, demographic needs change. Suddenly that big 10-acre kind of reservation in a neighborhood for a high school becomes redundant, and you can drive all around North America and you see landscapes of abandonment like that.
With urban growth comes the inevitable urban sprawl. How can urban planners and architects play a role in the mobility issues, the commuting issues?
You know, in any city, the sort of holy trinity or the tripartite that you have to really solve is the relationship between livelihoods, where people dwell, and the mobility systems that connect the two, right? An ideal city perhaps might be one where you could walk to work and vice versa, but in today's sort of scale of metropolitan regions, that doesn't happen very easily. And so I think planners have to be mindful of the relationship between this sort of tripartite and how one then orchestrates the mobility systems to make efficient connections between livelihoods and places of dwelling, or vice versa, locates places of dwelling and livelihoods based on existing mobility systems. And the synchrony between these three, I think, is critical in terms of addressing the question of sprawl. If you look at the American suburbs, because mobility is individual mobility, it's hard to orchestrate in terms of planning, because then it's complete freedom. And that's how we've got exaggerated sprawl, which then has no relationship to places of work and creates for very expensive mobility systems.
How do older cities, cities like Mumbai and Boston, accommodate this new density?
You know, cities deal with growth in two ways. And I think this is relevant for both Mumbai and Boston. They either open up more land on their peripheries, or they recycle land within their existing systems, right? So recycling land within your existing systems is like post-industrial land, where industry have now gone, and how do you kind of recycle it? And opening up land is how you orchestrate the metropolitan region. What's interesting is that both Boston and Mumbai historically opened up land through reclamation. So Boston's Back Bay, for example, is all reclaimed land. The hills were cut and land was reclaimed, and you had a spanking new, in that time, affordable housing added to the city. In Mumbai, the same thing happened. The hills were cut and we had the whole Back Bay reclamation and Marine Drive and many beautiful areas that accommodate, you know, the most livable kind of housing stock emerged. In the last couple of decades, as cities have got more expansive, it's become harder to kind of orchestrate these metropolitan regions. And I think in that sense, Boston has been more successful than Mumbai. Boston, for example, orchestrated growth around Route 128 when the high-tech companies were located there. And then you had suburbs where people lived close to their place of work. Of course, that changed with Silicon Valley on the West Coast. In Mumbai, mobility systems did not keep pace with the expansion of the metropolitan region. And so, you know, the city ran into problems because it began to densify at its core much more. In Mumbai, when the textile mills closed down, a lot of land got available for the city within its existing urban system to be recycled to create those margins for expansion. Mumbai didn't use that successfully because I think the nexus between real estate developers and the politicians put other uses to that land and not the uses that were necessary. So that was unsuccessful. But essentially, cities have to be very aware that the only way they grow, then they deal with density, they deal with their own expansion, is to simultaneously address how land within an urban system is renewed and then how land in its peripheries is orchestrated through mobility systems.
And in addition to the mass migration issue, one also has to think about conservation, specifically in an older city, and connecting the present with the past, honoring heritage and tradition. Which cities do you think are getting it right? And actually, you've got some projects that you've worked on where you've really tried to connect these two things.
Conservation is a really interesting issue in the context of urban planning. And it's also something we tend to universalize in terms of how we might approach it, but actually is very specific to a locality. The way I see conservation is it's an instrument of planning that helps any society modulate the rate of change. And every society deals with this differently. So let's take one extreme, which is London, in the context of the UK. You know, the British are very nostalgic about their golden past when the sun didn't set on the British Empire. And they're very nostalgic about change. And so conservation legislation in London is extreme. And their practices of conservation are, you know, admired by the world because they're really rigorous about it. But that's because that society is using conservation to slow that rate of change. In China, on the other extreme, when that society is wanting to transform both its political, social, and cultural landscape, conservation is very low down in their priorities. Of course, now, as they have begun to acquire wealth and become proud of their cities, conservation is being discussed in Shanghai and Beijing, but minimally compared to many other parts of the world. And so conservation is a very useful mechanism to create continuity in terms of change, because every society deals with change differently. It has to do with nostalgia. It has to do with also the stability of the built fabric. And I think the way we used conservation productively, I believe, in planning in Mumbai, is to minimize the disruptions in an urban fabric that was already operating quite well. And this is specific to Mumbai. Really, we didn't use nostalgia as the mechanism to drive the conservation process. We used questions of environment. We used questions of reuse. How could you reuse assets that already existed and expand their margins in terms of accommodating uses, whether for culture or for other social uses that the city wasn't providing adequately in the contemporary times? And so, basically, I think conservation should not be universalized, and every city should use it as an instrument that helps it in its own ways, for its own requirements, modulate the rate of change.
What can we learn from other cities, and how can we apply those solutions? You talk about how there are no universal solutions, but there must be some things that we can apply.
You know, in cities, I think the comparative mode has become very popular. And in the comparative mode, we look at best practices, which then finally come down to projects. So let's look at, for example, a city like Medellin in Colombia, which had a very particular condition of squatter settlements or the informal city occupying the slopes of the kind of topography that characterizes the city. And what they did through a very clever intervention was a multimodal mobility system, which combined not only the mass rapid transport system, which is a train and a subway, but combined it with a cableway, ropeway system, which could negotiate the topography much more easily. And the multimodal change was designed very efficiently. And so suddenly you had completely marginalized people that were integrated in this larger system. Now, recognizing the fact that you needed people of the lowest income groups to be integrated in the mobility system so they could be connected to their livelihoods, their dwelling places, and the mobility system worked in sync, was brilliant. Now, it was a very localized solution because no one would have thought about a ropeway. That's not part of the repertoire of planning tools that we kind of use. But it kind of, opened up mobility for these people, both physically, but also in economic terms. And I think that's a very local solution.
What can we take about the process of that example and apply perhaps elsewhere?
When we talk about impermanence and permanence, if you think about it in cities, more than the architecture and the streets and the buildings, cities often have very permanent governance systems. And that's why they're not nimble. They're bureaucratic, and we complain about that all the time. So they're not nimble in the ways they could react to a quick disaster or a sudden shift in demography or migration and all of that. And I think in the Medellin case, they bypassed it by creating a system that could respond very rapidly to something they saw was a solution. And so sometimes bypassing even governance systems, which seem politically hard to do, are very important lessons to learn, say, in a case of Medellin, or from the Kumbh Mela that we studied, which is, you know, the world's largest gathering of people on this planet, which is an impermanent megacity, an ephemeral megacity. And the most fascinating thing there was that they have a governance system where the intrinsic structure of the governance system shifts every 3 or 4 months, depending on the stage at which the city is in terms of its building. So it starts with a top-down, heavily bureaucratic 2-year process where funds are deployed. But by the time the city is about to get functional, it goes down to the bureaucrat who's otherwise the lowest in that rung. And he suddenly acquires all the power to actually make it happen on the ground. And so we've got to also re-examine our governance systems.
And Kumbh Mela is the festival city.
The Kumbh Mela is a festival that occurs every 12 years on the confluence of the Ganges and the Yamuna. And for this gathering, which is 7 million people living there for 55 days and 120 million people approximately visiting it on 3 sacred days in that period of 55 days, an entire megacity is set up. But it's an ephemeral megacity because it's reversible. It gets dismantled at the end of those 55 days. And they set up a temporary governance structure, but it's not a governance structure that is static for those days. Even within the period of the festival, it shifts depending on what they're anticipating in terms of the flux that will occur there in numbers of human beings who will visit. And so the governance system also works on this sort of temporal scale.
With great agility.
Great agility, very nimble in terms of responding to contingencies that might arise either because of an unseasonal rain and the river suddenly swelling, for example, or a stampede which has happened in the past. It allows that system to be far more nimble than the usual bureaucracies that run our more permanent cities.
Speaking of bureaucracies, so often plans, architectural and urban design plans, are held up by bureaucracy. And often this is because a lot of these plans require big budgets. Does smart urban design and planning always require a big budget? Or can there be things done on smaller budgets, but with big impact?
Absolutely. And I don't think it's a matter of one or the other. It's a matter of the balance between the two. It goes back to ideas like the evolution and involution of the city, or the permanent and the temporary. I think we generally, as human beings, tend to swing to extremes. The balance in between, which is a combination, a simultaneity of small projects and large projects, is what sort of makes for the most successful cities, where cities are simultaneously thinking of big budget projects, which sometimes have a longer time durée, which have to do with infrastructure, which have to do deployment of resources for particular kinds of services. But if they forget the small projects, just the improvement of a little public park, the renovation of a high school or a library, the pedestrianization of a street, albeit just for the weekends, those are small projects. You know, people call it acupuncture urbanism, where you just go in and compensate for the pain in the system by just doing something that might, serve citizens for a weekend or get traffic off a street for a week. It might be a celebration, or it might be a cyclic, predictable kind of activity. But I think that balance between the small moves, small projects that can be deployed very quickly, that can kind of be built on consensus more locally, but also simultaneously not losing sight of bigger projects that have longer time durée, that need bureaucracies. Otherwise we create imbalances, as in anything in life, I guess.
If you could change anything about the current conversation on global urban design, what would it be?
For me, it would be to move the scale at which we discuss urban design. So urban design, which is otherwise discussed at the scale of a downtown area or a part of a city, should move to a territory. In the United States, we should be looking at the whole eastern board and looking at how one orchestrates growth going all the way from Boston to Washington, correct? And the implication of that is we've got to move away from individual mobility at that scale and emphasize infrastructure that would be about collective mobility. You know, the high-speed train is an absolute must. What this would do at the territorial scale is open up huge zones of land and infrastructure, like all your freeways, to become strips of renewed, reimagined infrastructure. These will become the trunk lines on which maybe even your rail can run. Maybe they can be just covered over solar panels and they'll become your strips for energy right through the territory. And I think the amount of land that is being occupied for individual mobility is just out of proportion with what we really need if we have to survive as human beings and create new imaginations for our habitat in the future.
Rahul, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks very much.
You've been listening to Perspectives in Motion, an original podcast from Schindler. I'm Amy Gutman. You can find additional episodes, guest bios, and other related content on our website, schindler.com/podcast.